Hi there. This episode is triggered by the fact that a few days ago I was assessed for autism for the third time. And I really want to talk about the process and the story as to why that's ended up happening. I'm still slightly processing it, to be honest. I'm still trying to make sense a little bit of whether I've made the right decisions, whether it could have gone a different way, if it needed to go a different way. But I think ultimately, I am where I am, and I just think there's always value in seeing whether there's anything of note, and anything to learn, and anything to share, I guess, and potentially seek to improve, for all of us. So this is a little bit of a story time. And it started 2 years ago. Just over 2 years ago, I figured out that I'm autistic. And I've told that story on this podcast before, how I actually figured that out in season one. And I've never doubted it for a moment. In fact, in that couple of years, all that's happened is my self-knowledge has strengthened. I've learned a lot more about what aspects of my experience and the experiences of my family are very clearly rooted in autism. I've learned a lot about the community and what the community is doing and where we have diversity and where we have different views, and that's all fine. And I've also learned a lot about neurodivergent affirming approaches to things, which at the very beginning I didn't know about. And at the very beginning, I wasn't particularly affirming of myself, even though I fully accepted and was really only pleased about kind of discovering that I'm autistic. I still thought that it was my responsibility to adapt and change and be different, basically. And then I learned more about masking, and the importance of not being heavily masked, and for lots and lots of reasons, all of which I've talked about before. So 2 years ago, I got myself onto the NHS waiting list for an autism diagnostic assessment. And as I've said before, the reason wasn't really for me. It wasn't to confirm anything to me. It was really because there was a very strong sense that any one or any service or any employer or any system probably wouldn't take my word for it that I'm autistic. They would probably want some kind of, official validation of that. And the way to get official validation is through a formal diagnostic assessment. And that's ultimately what this episode is about, because it was and still is, to be honest, a bit unclear to me what constitutes a formal diagnostic assessment. So obviously, whatever I was going to get via the NHS would be some version of that. That would be a level of formality that would be accepted by the NHS and therefore presumably accepted by any other service or employer or anyone else in the future, if I would need to prove that I'm autistic in order to get any form of supports, any form of adjustments, to be taken seriously, basically. As we all know, that although the NHS is an incredible institution in the UK, it is massively under-resourced and it's really struggling with demand across all of its services. And so there is a long waiting list, and that includes children who would be, you know, potentially being assessed for various other types of support, speech therapy, occupational therapy, all things that I think should also be available to adults and aren't really. But this waiting list is for everybody. So the waiting list is also an indeterminate number of years. And I've already been on it now for 2 years. And there's no, you know, estimated time of arrival for me to have an assessment. I haven't heard anything. And they're struggling. So it's probably going to be a few years yet. So what did I do? What did I do back then? Was I thought about my options and I thought, well, I'm going to investigate getting a private assessment. And the NHS works in partnership with various private organisations which work with all different types of practitioners. So I knew that was out there. And I know that other people do it for ADHD, autism, and other things as well. So I started looking around. And that's when things got really confusing, because there isn't a sort of a detailed guide that I found that describes to someone who believes that they're autistic what they should be looking for in terms of the type of practitioner, the type of assessment methods, what standards they should be complying with, whether there are any sort of principles that organisations should be working to that we should be looking for, sort of, you know, values-based stuff. So I didn't find anything like that. So it really was a question of Googling and seeing what I found. And I did find, I found private consultancies, kind of psychiatry consultancies. And I'm not exactly anti-psychiatry, but psychiatry is medical model. And the descriptions of the assessments that I was seeing on some of these websites, I was kind of getting the impression that it was very impersonal. And I was thinking, well, maybe that's normal and maybe that's fine. And maybe that's exactly how the NHS does it. But my story is complicated, as are lots of adult autistic people's stories. And I just kind of had this sense that I don't get a sense that some of these consultancies in doing an assessment of someone like me would really get my autism. And then I found other types of consultants who work privately, based in Scotland and the Republic of Ireland, as well as in England. So then that brought up the question of, well, if I did an assessment with someone outside of England, would the services in England accept that? And those websites tended to make reference to lots of acronyms and technical aspects of autistic assessment that I was not familiar with. I was seeing the word DISCO, the acronym DISCO, quite a lot, and I didn't know what that was. Bearing in mind, this was a point in my life when I was very seriously burned out, completely overwhelmed, absolutely reeling from this realization that I'm autistic, trying to make sense of my whole life. It was all flashing before my eyes. So, you know, it's not like I had all of my personal resources and all of my capacity and all of my energy levels to be figuring all of this stuff out. So it was in that sort of state, and that kind of state of confusion, I suppose, that I found a website for somebody who was offering coaching for autistic people. And as part of that package, they were working with one or more practitioners who can offer what they were calling, you know, a diagnosis, a diagnostic assessment. And it was about the same price for this whole package as just the assessment through those private organisations. And so I inquired, and they were very autism affirming, neurodivergent themselves. And there are some aspects of this where I don't want to kind of give away, I don't want to breach confidentiality in terms of specific people that I was working with, because this is a very subjective experience that I'm describing. And what was on offer may have been absolutely fine from the perspective of others, but what I found myself getting into wasn't really fine for me, and actually left me feeling a bit duped, misled. And actually, at points on this journey, unsafe, and quite distressed. So it's sort of hard to... It's hard to describe this bit, but basically I did have an assessment. I did have an assessment with a practitioner that turned out to be someone that it wasn't a good fit for me. It wasn't someone who the coach really thought that they were. And I never got a written report from the assessment. Luckily, the coach was working with someone else as well, a speech and language therapist. And so it was arranged that as part of the package, I would have an assessment with that person instead. I had an assessment with that person. And it was a very positive experience in that I was much more assured of their current, you know, professional registrations, currently employed by the NHS as a specialist autism diagnostician and speech and language therapist, very affirming, very transparent in terms of what they were offering. But this is kind of where the issue arose, because actually what that practitioner was offering attached to this coaching package was not what they would call the full kind of NHS equivalent, you know, meeting all of the standards set by the organisation that sets standards. I'll come on to that in a minute. Which was what the coach had described, really. So I went ahead with the assessment and I got a written report, and the written report very clearly stated, this is not a full diagnostic assessment. This is a consultation discussion with someone who is qualified, trained, and currently practicing in this field of specialism, in order really to kind of affirm somebody's self-identification as autistic. So I had that written report. It was helpful at the time. It was enough to share with my employer. It was enough to help me feel even more confident than I was feeling, even though I was very confident about being autistic. And then when I went into the coaching sessions, I also came to the conclusion that actually it was maybe not the level of coaching that I would want and need at this point in my life. I am relatively experienced and senior professionally. I was asking big questions about what was sustainable. Was it even possible for me to keep doing the kind of work I do? was it realistic to kind of keep being a manager in my job? All of which now I've made sense of and spoken about quite a lot on this podcast. But at the time, I really felt like I needed someone very experienced in coaching, qualified, accredited, and very experienced in the kind of experiences that I was trying to navigate. And that wasn't the case with this particular coach. And so I discontinued the coaching. I think I had maybe two sessions and then I discontinued it. So like I said, it is subjective. I felt a bit like I had been missold, and that I had spent a lot of money on something that actually, if I had gone direct to this practitioner who ended up doing my second short consultation session, which was just a conversation, and I've actually done a podcast episode about this in season one, because I thought I'd had a diagnosis. But I could have had that basically for significantly less money if I hadn't gone through this kind of coaching package. And I also would have saved myself probably the stress of having had that first assessment, which was actually quite an upsetting experience. So what happened then? I didn't really want to admit to myself that I hadn't had a full diagnostic assessment, but equally I'd had a consultation with somebody very experienced and very specialist. I still had no doubt that I was autistic. I was embarrassed that I had spent all of this money on something that wasn't equivalent to what I would get on the NHS. So I stopped thinking about it. And continued basically doing my own personal reflections, my own, you know, reading all the books about autism, and, you know, still to this day, I have no doubts. So why did I go for a third assessment? And I don't even know if I fully know the answer to this, but I've made some notes. I've been thinking about it. Recently, you may know, well, not that recently, a year and a half ago, my father died. And he knew he was autistic. I knew I was autistic right at the end of his life. We talked about it. 18 months later, we've sold the family home. We've bought my mother a flat. She's going to need, you know, probably a lot of that money for care services. We're very fortunate. It's absolutely privileged that we had that asset to sell as a family. We've been able to distribute some of the funds a little bit. I got £10,000, and I may well get some more in the distant future, but it's very dependent on my mother's needs. Anyway, I got £10,000, and I thought, okay, let's not go crazy with this £10,000. Let's save as much of it as possible. But there are two things I want to do. I want to get my teeth fixed because they are a crooked mess and they are very difficult to take care of, and I can't floss them because they're very crowded and they're all chipping each other. And I was like, look, my dad had really crowded teeth that were a mess, and I've got really crowded. I'm just going to, with that money, I'm going to get the braces. So I've done that. I've got my Invisalign braces. And then I thought, I could now spend money again on actually accessing a full autism diagnostic assessment if I can just figure out what that is. So I contacted the specialist who did my second consultation assessment 2 years ago, and I said, look, this is basically what happened before. I misunderstood what was on offer. However, I found the experience with you very positive. I found you very transparent. I have no issue with, you know, what you were providing. The written report was very well done. It was an excellent experience. Do you do the more advanced, thorough, however you do what you do, do you do that privately? And this person said, yes. And this is how it works. It's an in-person with two practitioners, so them and a clinical psychologist, in person up in Yorkshire. It takes several hours. And the original consultation session, I should say, was via a Zoom call, and it was 1 hour. So very short, with no real kind of pre-screening questionnaires or anything like that. I sent them a lot of notes because I'd made a lot of notes, but that was the format of that one. So this full assessment involved doing several questionnaires ahead of the in-person appointment. They would have found it useful to have seen school reports, any evidence and information from a caregiver from my childhood. They also would find it very helpful to have input from someone who knows me very well now, and that is my husband, who I've been with for 23 years, knows me and my sort of specifics in terms of day-to-day strengths and challenges, how I communicate, how I express myself, my meltdowns, all of that stuff. That is my husband. So a much more thorough process. And the way they described it was NICE compliant. Now, NICE is the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence in England. And they basically go through the evidence base for every different health condition, every different treatment for every different health condition, the diagnostic methodology, care pathways, all of that stuff, tools, diagnostic tools. And they write the guidance for the NHS. And guidance is, it's more than just a suggestion. Like the NHS has to demonstrate, or is meant to demonstrate, doesn't always, that it is compliant with the guidance from NICE. So when they made mention of NICE, I was like, oh yes, I know about NICE. I know about that from my day job. So that gave me a level of assurance where I was thinking, okay, if this is what the NHS diagnostic assessment is based on, then what this person is describing does sound to me equivalent in terms of quality standards, and therefore, hopefully, acceptability by services should I need them in the future. Because one thing I'm very mindful about is, and I've spoken about a little bit on the podcast, is that actually support needs fluctuate dramatically over the course of a life, and things can get quite complicated for autistic people in later life. So I want to be as prepared as possible for that. So just checking that I've covered off my reasons for doing it. The other reason that I wanted to do it was partly for personal research purposes, partly because I want to understand everything about the autistic care pathway and the diagnosis and whether it's working for us as a population, and whether it's affirming or not, and whether it's accurate or not. And I'm not saying I can do this completely on my own, but I do think I can contribute to, you know, collective thinking about this and influencing, especially given what I do for a living. So I wanted to go through the full process. I want to know what all of the screening surveys are. I want to know what the actual assessment methods are. And I'm a bit impatient about that, to be quite honest. So that's part of it. You know, I don't like uncertainty, which is, you know, classic as an autistic person. I don't like not knowing how long it will take and how many years I'll have to wait. And as I said, I was lucky financially to have the option to do it now. Also, I have heard lots of things from lots of different people about being assessed on the NHS. Some people have had perfectly fine experiences and lots of people haven't. And that includes issues with assessors not understanding what a masking autistic person looks like and how we behave. Not that I'm super masked now, but I am masked, actually. If I feel unsafe, if I'm with someone unfamiliar, if I'm in an unfamiliar place. So actually there's a high possibility of being masked in an NHS assessment. I also don't know that I can be completely confident that someone assessing me via the NHS is really competent in working with adults, in working with adults who are not men or white men or, you know, heterosexual white men or, you know, what am I trying to say? Who would be confident in any form of intersectionality, including working with an adult woman when there is so much discourse about the autistic experience of girls and women being so misunderstood, even by practitioners. So there were quite a few reasons, to be honest, that I thought, you know, I'm very lucky to be able to get the opportunity to choose a private practitioner and go for it. So because I knew I liked this practitioner that I had seen briefly very much, I trusted in their expertise. I know that they work with adults. We had already had that consultation and it had been very affirming for me. So I knew they knew all about masking. They knew how I could have ended up in such a kind of senior career job, even though actually I really struggle with a lot of household type things. And I trusted them, basically. I trusted their expertise. So, okay, I know this is a really long, detailed episode, so thank you for sticking with me if you're still with me. All right, so I'm going to go into the next bit now, which is the actually going for the assessment. So I should say I went for the assessment 6 days ago. It's Sunday now. I went on Monday and I haven't had the written report yet, but they did give me the outcome verbally on the day, which is that, yes, I meet the criteria for autism. So that is my current status. So going back now, 6 days ago, my husband and I, oh no, I'll go back a little bit before then, actually. So I was sent by email a number of screening surveys to send in ahead of the appointment. There was one about masking called the CAT-Q, and that stands for something to do with camouflaging. Camouflaging being another name for masking. So it was all about how I mask, why I mask, what I think other people are thinking of me. And obviously I don't really know what other people are thinking of me. But I do worry about what they're thinking about me, and that is a driver for acting differently. There was also a questionnaire about my sensory profile, and that was structured very nicely. It was very clear what different aspects of my sensory experience were being questioned there. And as I was doing these questionnaires, I was thinking to myself, I have a feeling I'm going to be quite high scoring on these, but actually I don't know my scores yet. I'm assuming that's going to be in my written assessment. And then there was also a social responsiveness scale, which I think was about, all these surveys were quite long. I think that one was about more about how much I'm able to kind of read what's happening in a social interaction, whether or not I think I can understand what people are thinking and feeling just by looking at them, which I can't, they have to tell me, those kinds of things. I didn't have any input from a caregiver. My mother is definitely multiply neurodivergent, and she sent me a very loving message ahead of my assessment, but wasn't able to provide anything from my childhood. And I had a few school reports, not at all a full catalogue. And I had sent in some of those things. And my husband was also asked, in place of a caregiver, was also asked to do one of the questionnaires. I think the social responsiveness scale he was asked to do, which he did confidentially. He could have shown me, I could have asked, but I actually said, let's just keep it simple. I won't look at what you've sent in. And then what I knew was they were going to be doing on the day, there was going to be something called the ADOS, or the ADOS, which is the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. I think there are different versions of this. I think I did the one called the ADOS G. That's the one that is cited on the NICE guidance, which I have now looked at. And I knew that was going to be them observing me doing a number of activities. And they apologise in advance because these tests are designed for children and they are very childish. And I'm really glad that we talked about it in advance. I didn't look up what the specific tests were because I thought, no, I'm going to go in and be assessed. I'm going to go in and be observed. They will be looking for how I approach these activities. They will be looking for whether I process information in a classically autistic way or not. So I'm not going to look up ahead of time what they are. I had heard tales of a book, a storybook about frogs, which I did in fact encounter in the assessment. But the point is they're for children and they are not appropriate really for adults, and a lot of people have felt very humiliated by doing these. But because I had gone with someone trusted and because they acknowledged this ahead of the assessment, when I went in and did the assessment and did that observational set of activities, it was fine. And actually we had a bit of a laugh because I don't know exactly what they were looking for, but from what I know about autistic traits and autistic information processing and the struggle, like, I know I can't tell stories. I've never been able to make up a story and tell a story, even if I've got a picture book. So I was like, I have no idea what is happening in this book. I will describe everything I see on the page, which is different, isn't it, to telling a story. So in fact we had a bit of a laugh during the assessment, which helped me a lot. I didn't feel humiliated at all. I felt very much that they were on my side. And going into the whole day, they said, look, this is a collaborative experience. We are working with you. We're not just watching you all kind of sterile and cold, which is unfortunately what some people experience in their assessments. It's a collaboration. So, ahead of going for this face-to-face, actually, the thing I had been most nervous about, given that I'd had this really positive contact with them beforehand, the thing I was most nervous about was, A, am I going to be able to remember all of my examples of everything under these five headings that they mentioned in the email, which I haven't jotted down, actually. But the headings are things like communication, interaction, sensory experiences, and then another couple of headings. So I'll see if I can remember those. I'll see if I can craftily just have a quick look at the email. Oh, I'll look at my notes, actually. So what I did was, on my phone, I made a ginormous list of all of my classic stuff. Okay, here we go. Communication, interaction, interests, routines, repetitive behaviours, sensory differences. Okay, so they were the headings that they mentioned in an email to me we were going to be having a lot of conversation about. Now, I don't know exactly because they didn't tell me exactly what methods they were using, but I suspect this is the DISCO interview, which is the autism diagnostic interview, which would be a structured kind of methodology around interviewing someone about their experiences that would be looking for, you know, typically autistic experiences under those headings. So I wrote a ginormous list of all of the things, just as things came to me over the few days ahead of my assessment, under those headings, and I brought that list with me and just had it like on the table in front of me in case I wanted to look at it. And I was nervous, funny enough, I was nervous about, am I going to have to go and sit in a hard chair for however many hours this thing is going to take? Because sitting still in a hard chair is really, really, really horrible for me. And I was thinking to myself, I need to know that I can sit on the floor, I can move around, I can put, you know, sit with my legs up, roll around, you know, all of that stuff. But I didn't worry about it too much because I knew that these were autistic affirming practitioners, and actually it was taking place in a place that was specifically designed as a sort of like a sensory inclusive, neurodivergent inclusive space. They actually had a they've actually got a specific clinic up in Yorkshire set up to do this. And when I got there, I was really delighted because we were using this lovely room with a sofa, plushies on the sofa, really gentle colours, lots of nice cosy things. And I was like, oh, good, it's a comfy place. So I sat on the sofa with my legs up, squashing this plushie. And whenever I needed to kind of lie down or take a quick 5 minute lie down, which I often do during the day, that was completely fine. I could take breaks whenever I wanted to, I could eat whenever I wanted to, and we had a 45 minute lunch break as well. So it took 6 hours including lunch, and it was intense, don't get me wrong, I was tired at the end, but the whole experience was positive, supportive, affirming, relaxed. And I really felt like we were a team kind of working through this assessment together. So, yeah, that is basically what happened. And my husband, he chipped in on a few things, but actually I talked a lot. And, you know, partly because of doing this podcast and doing my Instagram reels, it's relatively easy for me now, you know, to articulate all kinds of experiences that I know to be autistic experiences. And I've been able to filter out experiences that I understand really were kind of trauma experiences. And that can be one of the things that's very difficult for practitioners to sort through when they're doing an assessment with an autistic adult, because most of us do have complex trauma and maybe in really quite a traumatized state at the time of being assessed. But I'm not, you know, I think there are a lot of benefits in a way to doing this 2 years later. My mental health is good. I'm not in a traumatized state. I'm not burned out. I'm able to articulate a lot of my autistic experience. And so I think that's one of the reasons it was probably fairly straightforward, where at the end of the day, they were able to say, look, we are obviously going to consult with each other and do your written report, but you very clearly meet the criteria for autism. And in fact, they said, and I did laugh, they said, actually, we would have been able to come to that conclusion even without having done the observational activity tests. So I was like, yeah, that's what I thought. I'm super autistic. That's exactly what I thought. So, yeah, it feels basically like I have accessed the gold standard that I would like to be available for everyone else who would like to have an assessment like that experience that I have described. And I think now that I've experienced it, I'm very grounded in the knowledge of what that looks like, feels like, how it can be done, how unnecessary it is for these assessments to be impersonal, sterile, feeling judgmental. You know, I've since that day, I've been Googling a lot more actually about the ADOS observational tests and this storybook and people's experience of it. And actually, a lot of people had a very distressing experience because it felt humiliating. It did not feel collaborative. It felt like, you know, being tested and being caught out and being judged. And it very clearly to me now does not need to be like that. And I've become more familiar now with the NICE guidance. And I've also got this wonderful book, which I super recommend if you're interested in reading a book, called The Adult Autism Assessment Handbook, A Neurodiversity Affirmative Approach, by Davida Hartman, Tara O'Donnell Killen, Jessica Doyle, Dr. Maeve Kavanagh, Dr. Anna Day, and Dr. Juliana Azevedo, if that's the correct way to pronounce that name, from Jessica Kingsley Publishers, published in 2023. So it's very much the cutting edge of, and, you know, reading it now, flicking through it, I'm like, yeah, this is the affirming assessment that I have just had. And it is possible. It is possible. So I've been looking at the NICE guidance. Now, the NICE guidance is open enough and vague enough that, sure, it would absolutely encourage an approach like the one that I've had. It uses language of partnership. You know, staff doing assessments should work in partnership with adults. They should take the time to develop trusting, supportive, empathic and non-judgmental relationships. That's in the NICE guidance. But equally, I think it's clearly very possible to carry out assessments that are compliant with the NICE guidance enough that actually are a very, you know, non-affirming and non-collaborative experience. So I'm very keen to learn more about which practitioners in the UK are doing it in an affirming way, in a collaborative way, and getting more of the specifics about how they're going about that, what kind of expertise they've got, you know, what the space should look like, what the conversations should look like. Because I do think actually the guidance should be updated. It was updated in 2021, so NICE probably think it's too early to update. That's normally how it goes. But I think they are very, very behind the times already. And I think this book, this 2023 book, demonstrates that very clearly. So I think there is some influencing work to do, some campaigning work to do. And obviously this stuff needs to be properly resourced as well, which in itself is quite a problem to solve. But I'm all about problem solving. So I'm sure there are others who want to get into that conversation as well. So that's basically the story. And I wanted to share it because, you know, initially I was embarrassed about the fact that I've already done an episode about being diagnosed. I was worried that people would think that I had perhaps been presenting myself as someone who had been through a formal diagnosis like this, when I hadn't. And did that matter? Because I'm actually very, very pro self-ID anyway. I don't think we should be required to go through this much rigor for people to believe that we're autistic. I expect people to believe me when I say that I'm autistic, even without having gone through this. So I still have an awful lot of processing, I think, to do around that. But I also know that a lot of people very much want access to this kind of rigor and this kind of level of expertise to have a full assessment. And I have to say that although I didn't want it to change how I felt about myself, and I didn't doubt that I was autistic, it's still comforting to know that two expert practitioners have spent 6 hours with me and have concluded that I am definitely autistic. So, you know, whatever I've had access to, I would like to be available to anyone who wants it, without having to fund it themselves, because it really does change lives, having this kind of validation and certainty. And what obviously we need to get into now is So then what support is there? What is the care pathway? Loads and loads and loads of loads to do on this. But it's, 45 minutes exactly that I've been talking. So I will call it a day. I'd love to hear from you. I'm on email. Email address should be on the description of this podcast, whichever platform you're listening on. And I'm very active on Instagram. So if you're there, you can find me at Autistic at 40 podcast. And I do reels most days. And I'm pretty good at direct messaging on Instagram as well. Don't forget about my free online forum, discussion forum, Autistihood. Get in touch with me in those same ways that I've just described. You're very welcome to join if you are an autistic adult, an adult with autism. You're very welcome to join. It's free. It always will be. It's a supportive space for autistic adults. Okay, take care. Love you all loads. Bye.